Take a deep breath. And remember, there's a power. Breathing you. This is your space of sanity in an evolving world, where we learn about spiritual law and how to apply it to our lives in a way that is practical and life-changing. This is where we remember truth to make the world a better place, one person at a time. I'm Claire Lautier, inspirational speaker, teacher of the technology of transformation, and a certified life mastery consultant and spiritual growth mentor. Welcome to the Grace Space. We've been talking about sacred intimacy for a few weeks now, and I've been sharing with you how I've come to understand it as the experience of feeling at home in yourself. So at home in yourself, so comfortable with yourself as you are right now, that you realize you're okay, you're provided for, and that everything in the universe is in order, no matter what it looks like on the surface. Your life can be a mess. Your life can be topsy-turvy, upside down, and yet you still feel a profound sense of okayness inside yourself. Sacred intimacy nurtures trust in yourself and life, and gradually attenuates any fear you might have had about what others think about you. There's less of a tendency to want to people please, to want to project yourself in a certain way, less of a need to become someone and get to the point where you tell yourself that you've made it. There's less of a tendency to distract yourself from yourself, because really, at the end of the day, that's what we seek to distract ourselves from, the discomfort of our own company, of our own thoughts, feelings, and basic self-rejection. Sacred intimacy is the experience of being connected with the incorruptible sacredness of your true nature. It makes you feel clean and brand new, like springtime. Last season on this podcast, I shared with you the spiritual name that I was given many years ago, and how I went from not having much of a connection with it to beginning to embody it. I can tell you now that growing into and accepting that spiritual name has transformed my life and given me a touchstone that has become sacred intimacy. My spiritual name is Sukhbir, and that's what I'm called when I go to the ashram. Your spiritual name is the frequency of your higher self. And when you work with that frequency and take it on, to whatever extent you do, you begin to vibrate at that frequency more and more. The name is also multidimensional. It reveals many layers to you over time. Or maybe it's that you begin to embody different colors or facets of the name over time. I've discovered how rich my spiritual name is as I've come to understand in my body what it encompasses, vibrationally speaking. Sukh is most often translated as peace or serenity, but it goes so much deeper than any words. Words are always pointers, as Eckhart Tolle says, pointers towards something. When you point at the moon, you're directing the other person to look at the moon, not at your finger. As we move from a mental, intellectual approach to life to a felt understanding and embodiment over the years, we start experiencing the moon rather than the finger. And so it has been with my relationship with my spiritual name. Even the word relationship implies a duality, but it's moved from a relationship to an embodied frequency, and the journey of oneness with that frequency continues. Peace is a very high frequency, much more profound than the momentary feeling that I think we equate with peace or peacefulness, something that we experience as relative calm versus inner or outer disturbance. Peace as a spiritual level of consciousness is at the calibrated level of 600 on David Hawkins' scale of consciousness. It's just below enlightenment at 700, and is associated with the emotional state of bliss and the process of illumination. Do I spend my days at the consciousness level of peace because my spiritual name is Sukhbir? No, I do not. I do not. But I have experienced that state of consciousness. And let me tell you that even a few moments of calibrated level 600, i.e. peace, will change your life forever. That state has nothing to do with what we normally experience as peace. It's the peace, the peace that passes or surpasses all understanding. But Sukh has other facets that are also deeply satisfying states related to peace. These states are more accessible, like stepping stones to peace, such as comfortableness, coziness, and what I call meltingness, like the feeling you have when you sit by a fire with a cup of cocoa and a blanket and you feel utterly safe and cared for. It's that feeling of coming home and shedding your burdens. Come to me, all of you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. When you feel that feeling, really feel it with no external cause, but simply welling up from inside yourself, you get it. You're like, oh, that's what they mean by that feeling of coming home. And you realize deep inside yourself that never, not once, have you ever been judged by the universe. Not once. Not one single time for anything that you've ever done. That at any moment, you are welcomed with open arms, with joy, with celebration, into the oneness with a kind of melting love that is indescribable. It's that feeling that we have of needing our mother, in that moment where she puts her arms around us and holds us close, multiplied times infinity. And you realize that the only one who is ever giving you a hard time is you. So, Sukh. The second part of my spiritual name is Bir, and that's defined as bravery or courage. And when you put the two sounds together, Sukh Bir, the message is that the state of peace and its ancillary or perhaps more accessible stepping stone facets of comfort, coziness, and the feeling of being utterly at home inside yourself, that these are the fruit of your courage. The courage to face your deepest fears and to integrate what you yourself have judged, rejected, dissociated from, denied, or otherwise banished into the recesses of the subconscious. That is the process. But that process can be summed up in those two little words, letting go, otherwise known as relaxing. Sukhbir, to me, is the essence of the spiritual warrior. But the spiritual warrior is not at war. The spiritual warrior is not in a battle. It's an attitude of surrender and open-hearted relaxation and trust in the moment. It takes a lot of strength, a lot of courage to be that open. But strength is not rigidity. Strength, real strength, is softness. So when you hold all of that darkness and you relax at the same time, it begins to transmute back into light. Well, actually, let me be a bit more clear, because darkness does not transform into light. Darkness is merely the absence of light to one degree or another. What's happening is that when you no longer repress or resist that which is, it simply dissolves. It becomes integrated somehow. It disappears. It's like a cloud that was blocking the sun. A cloud, not a clown. Like a clown blocking the sun. No, a cloud blocking the sun. And as everyone knows, when clouds dissolve, the sun is simply revealed as self-effulgent, radiant, brilliant. I don't know what happens when clowns dissolve, but I bet it's pretty funny. So, the vibration of the higher self, as expressed by the sound Sukhbir, has taught me a great deal about what I call sacred intimacy, because the willingness to look at everything, warts and all, brings you closer to yourself, your true self. The willingness to own all of it, all of the negative qualities, recognizing them as part of the ego, the mask, the persona, is just a necessary step in disidentifying from it. We know that the personal self is flawed, perfectly flawed. And all egos are the same ego. It's just that the energy of the ego is manifesting in a particular way as the light shines through this temporary form and the karma that it's carrying through the DNA and Kaushik body. So what's the big deal? Who can call you names or point the finger at you without three fingers pointing back at them and say anything about you that is ultimately true? No one can. In my quest to leave no stone unturned regarding whatever was blocking the light in me, I eventually ended up back in my body. The body is the material outpicturing of the subconscious mind. It tells us everything about what's going on in the parts of us that are unseen, unlistened to, unacknowledged, buried, denied, repressed. The body somatizes all of this stuff for us. Like many women, I had a whole history of my body speaking to me through my reproductive organs. And like many women, I had my hands firmly over my ears and I was not very available to what it was trying to tell me, because that would have meant diving into an ocean of pain. And for a long time, I was not willing to do that. I said to myself, well, I'm dealing with all this stuff over here. And I kind of tried to bargain with the universe, like, well, you know, as long as I deal with all this stuff over here, then I don't have to deal with that stuff over there. Do I? And to some degree, it's true that when you work on a lot of stuff and you're doing a lot of the work, as a result, other things just kind of naturally take care of themselves as you let go. That does happen. But universal law is absolute. And eventually, whatever you are not willing to deal with, whatever you're trying to bargain with the universe for, whatever you might be using people and things in your life as a distraction from, it's going to take form in your life as a challenge, either internally or externally. So at some point on my journey, I knew I had to acknowledge the unprocessed pain and trauma that was stored in the second chakra. And the second chakra, you may or may not know, is the locus of everything that has to do with sexuality, creativity, money, flow, pleasure, and our one-to-one relationships with other people. Well, I'm 53 now, and when I was growing up and becoming a young woman, my sense of myself, my body, and my relationship with the systems of my body was not only a product of my incoming level of consciousness and my family culture and inherited belief systems, but the larger context of the unconsciousness of the world we were all born into, and the allopathic medical model and its disease consciousness, treating the body like a mechanistic structure where anything can just go wrong at any moment, and we don't know why, nor did we ask ourselves what might be the underlying root causes of any imbalance. So when I started having yeast infections as a teenager, I was filled with fear and loathing and a terrible discomfort at having to broach the subject with my mother so as to receive treatment. Why? Well, because a yeast infection is not just an intolerable itch somewhere on the surface of your body, it's in your vagina. And in my mind and upbringing and consciousness, the vagina was this mysterious thing that we didn't talk about. An entryway into an even more mysterious world, and it equaled sexuality and shame and a whole host of icky feelings that I just did not know what to do with. To top it all off, the appearance of these yeast infections coincided with me having my first ever boyfriend, and I made some mental association between the fact of having a boyfriend and feeling sexual excitement for the first time, although I was still a virgin, with the appearance of this very unpleasant condition right where I was feeling the excitement. I had enough copies of 17 magazines stocked up in my bedroom that I could do my own preliminary research, and I did enough to know that yeast infection was not a sexually transmitted disease, but I was still extremely uneasy about broaching the subject with my mother. I mean, I didn't even tell my mother when I got my first period. I knew I would have to eventually, because I was 14 years old and I didn't buy my own pads and tampons. Somebody had to do it for me. So I just, I wasn't comfortable discussing such things, bringing them up with my mother. I wasn't happy or unhappy about it when it came. I just didn't say anything. I was so disconnected from my body. I allowed my mother, however, to find sanitary wrappers in the wastebasket and made her come to me. I still remember her coming into my bedroom and saying, "Do you have anything you want to tell me?" And replying, "No," innocently. And she had to push me further. "Do you want to tell me that you got your period?" And I was like, "Oh, yeah. Yeah." It wasn't that I was anticipating any negative reaction even. It's just that I didn't feel comfortable. Somehow, somewhere, I picked up or absorbed from the environment, whether it was at home or just out there in the world or in the media and television commercials and things like that, that this was something kind of dirty and that we shouldn't really discuss it in polite company. A lovely, affirming moment amid this awkwardness was that night when my father brought me a bouquet of flowers and hugged me with a lot of tenderness without ever saying anything embarrassing like, "Hey, you got your period." It was his way of honoring this rite of passage, and it was a beautiful act that made me feel special. But in my adolescent awkwardness, all I wanted to do was just crawl under the nearest rock and never come out. So this was the backdrop that was already in place when I began to have these yeast infections. And when I finally got the courage up to tell my mother, I said, "I think I need to go to the doctor." And I think she had a momentary fear that I could be pregnant because I had this new boyfriend. But again, I was a virgin. I had no intention of losing my virginity until the legal age of 18. Anyhow, when I told her that I thought I might have a yeast infection, there was a palpable relief in her body language. And she was sweet and kind and hugged me and said she would make an appointment at the gynecologist. So I got to go have my first pelvic exam shortly thereafter. Is this more than you ever, ever wanted to hear on the Grace Space? I mean, because we're getting into it now. See, the thing is, we don't tend to question the systems that we're born into, or at least I did not. As a young woman, I was very compliant, very obedient, very trusting of the systems that were already in place. I mean, who am I to question the world that I was born into? That was my attitude. In the years leading up to my adolescence, my mother properly prepared me for the changes that my body was going to go through, like any good mother of that era would have done. I remember very clearly the book that she brought home one day called Period. I remember the cover of this book. It was royal blue, and it had written in big white letters the word period with a little spot next to it, a period, in red. And my mother very lovingly sat me down to read this book with me out loud about menstruation. I remember tolerating it, but being very uncomfortable again. This book even had little drawings that you could cut out. They were drawings of the uterus, and there were two of them. A larger one, which was meant to be the size of the uterus and fallopian tubes and ovaries of a grown woman, and a smaller one, which was meant to be the size of a uterus and fallopian tubes and ovaries of a prepubescent girl. And this book was an illustrated explanation of the natural changes that occur when you go from being a girl to a woman, how different women experience their periods. Like, some of them might feel tired and want to stay home in bed and read a book, and some of them might feel super active and want to go out and play sports. And there was a section of the book where they talked about how you should go for your first pelvic exam, that was a natural part of this rite of moving from girlhood to womanhood. That was just the assumption that now that you're becoming a woman, You need to be participating in the medical system. You need to be examined to make sure that everything is okay, and this was normalized. The book went on to describe what you could expect in a routine pelvic exam, and I remember feeling horrified that I would have to be subjected to such an examination, even though they made it look all soft and sweet in their drawings. I believe that this was all just part of the indoctrination into the medical system and the belief that your functions as a woman need to be monitored. The process of disempowerment, already well underway just because of the water you're swimming in, becomes official here. The subliminal messaging is that you don't know anything about your body. You need someone else to tell you about it. The condition of being a woman is a problematic one, and that the natural physiological functions of a woman's body are treated as disease processes. Now listen, I am not faulting any of the fine medical professionals out there who are in this to help people. I am talking about a system that teaches those well-intentioned people what to think, not how to think. I'm talking about a for-profit interventional model where medical schools are funded by pharmaceutical companies and teach future doctors to be prescribers of the medications created by those companies rather than healers, rather than a healing model where the intention is getting to the bottom of the root causes of illness and doing everything possible to support nature and the body's intelligence. So starting with your first pelvic exam, you are taught to basically outsource your power. You're taught to check your breasts for lumps. You're routinely given a pap smear to check for abnormalities in your cells, and you're absorbed into a culture that believes that at any moment, your body might just betray you randomly and start acting in an unhealthy way. And as you grow up and go through the natural cycles of womanhood, menstruation is disturbed by carcinogenic birth control pills. Pregnancy has to be monitored. Birth has to be monitored in a hospital setting or even scheduled. Menopause is a problem. You're told that it's just more convenient to have your reproductive organs removed. And you're offered drugs every step of the way to intervene and override the body's natural wisdom. What is perfectly natural and innately intelligent is made unnatural. And the old ways, the natural ways, are distrusted. Your natural, innate, intuitive, feminine wisdom is put aside. Women become utterly disconnected from their cycles, unable or even unaware of the signs of fertility, burdened by painful menses and menopause, and divorced from their innate power. I know that this is not news to a lot of people, and that more and more women are embracing alternative, natural health modalities as they realize that they were totally shunted into a system that was not natural, not in harmony with nature. But when you're a young girl, or I'll just speak for myself, when I was a young girl, I was certainly not in a position to question or to seek any alternative way of framing my experience of entering into womanhood. So I went for this first pelvic exam because I was suffering from a yeast infection, and thus I entered into the gynecological branch of the allopathic medical model. The gynecologist was a woman, which was a relief, but she was also the mother of a boy in my high school class, and I imagine the humiliation of being mentioned at the dinner table, like, oh, guess who came in for a pelvic exam today? Your little friend Claire, which of course never would have happened, but that was a product of my overactive adolescent mind. But I can honestly say that this first pelvic exam remains in my memory as an early trauma to my womanhood. I went in there, I was already embarrassed. Oh my God, excuse me. I swear that wasn't me. I swear that was not me. Actually, it's my fart app. A couple episodes ago, I told you I have a fart app. And some people were like, you do not. Yes, I do. And it's sitting here, it's on, and it will fart randomly when you least expect it. And I told you that I use my fart app when you least expect it. So, lest we get too serious, when the gynecologist examined me, she asked me, while my legs are up in stirrups, and I'm being penetrated by this cold metal instrument for the first time. She asks me, "Are you a virgin?" And I replied truthfully, "Yes, I am." And as she's looking into my vagina, she says to me in a tone of reproach, "Are you sure?" I was so shocked that she should doubt my veracity, I came back with a brittle, "Yes, I'm sure." Now, I don't know what she saw up there to make her doubt my word. Probably the hymen was broken, which I can trace back to slipping on my banana-shaped bicycle seat as a very young child. I mean, we know nowadays that the hymen can break at any time during childhood through just such an accident or through, I don't know, horseback riding or any other number of ways. But this gynecologist questioned me and, through her questioning and her attitude, intimidated me while she was penetrating me with an instrument. And this cemented the link of guilt between this yeast infection and the tender early joy of discovery of sexual energy. And there was a part of me that feared that this yeast infection was a punishment for budding sexual interest. I was given the medication of the day, which was some form of antibiotic, and a douche, and told how to use it, which I did, and I was given a topical cream with cortisone in it, probably, and amazingly, the symptoms somewhat abated, only to come raging back a few weeks later, even worse than before. Well, this time I felt even guiltier, as we had to go to the pharmacy and re-up on the medications, which I used, and it must have been by some placebo effect that once again the infection went into dormancy. But when it happened a third time a few weeks later, I thought, there is no way I'm going back to my mother to talk about this again, because I had a guilty conscience as if I had done something wrong and brought this on myself somehow. This time, I went to my boyfriend, my sweet, innocent boyfriend, whose aunt, as it happened, was a gynecologist in another state. He was so sweet. He took me in his car to a payphone on the side of the road somewhere, and I remember because it was rainy and windy that day, and there I was sheltering myself inside this phone booth, putting quarters in with trembling hands to speak to my boyfriend's aunt who lived in another state to ask her to prescribe medication that my boyfriend could then go and pick up for me. We went through this ridiculous subterfuge because I was so embarrassed and ashamed, and I didn't want to be exposed to the injustice of being subtly slurred as a slut by the gynecologist I had seen. This is what was going on in my psyche in that first year of tender, budding womanhood. It wasn't until years later, when I was in my 30s and I began looking into alternative healing, alternative diets, and trying to put together the puzzle pieces of my health picture outside of the conventional models, that I realized why I had had those yeast infections as a teenager. I had been having skin breakouts, and back then they used to give us antibiotics for acne. My dad was a doctor. I grew up in that world where if you were sick in any way, the solution was a pill. And because my dad was a medical doctor, he could get me a prescription for erythromycin, which was the antibiotic that was recommended by dermatologists for breakouts. It was a little orange pill. I was taking erythromycin like they were candy. And it's fairly common knowledge nowadays that antibiotics destroy your gut flora, and that if you don't supplement to restore that flora, there's going to be a domino effect in your body, and very often the result is, in women at least, yeast infections. I had been taking erythromycin for my skin for a few months. The natural flora in my body were eradicated by overuse of antibiotics, and the result was yeast infections. Simple. Nothing to do with being sexually active or having a boyfriend or maybe being a slut. The body was out of balance, that's all. In a different world, in a different consciousness, I might have been given cranberry juice or cranberry supplements or told to fast for 24 hours and rebuild my gut flora naturally. In a different world or a different consciousness, we might have looked for a natural solution to why my skin was breaking out in the first place. But that was not the world that I grew up in, and it's nobody's fault. Everybody was being as loving as they could be and trying to help me. Many, many years later, I began the work to heal the past in my second chakra and reproductive organs, going all the way back to those early years, trying to understand the cumulative nature of the micro-traumas, or maybe not so micro, to my womanhood, trying to understand how I had died inside, why I had no feeling in parts of my body that I remembered from those tender years of awakening sexuality. Those parts had been alive with sensation and an innocent sense of wonder. How had I become numb and dissociated from my yoni? It wasn't any one thing. It was many things, many insults to her sensitivity, her natural openness, her trustingness, in the form of cold metal instruments, prescription drugs, birth control pills, heartbreak, well-meaning but inept lovers, faking orgasms, unconscious orgasms, people-pleasing, abortion, sexually transmitted disease, lack of curiosity and caring, deception, little white lies, big glaring lies, lying to myself, lying to others, being objectified, pap smears, saying yes when I meant no, saying no when I meant yes, shame, guilt, self-hatred, disempowerment, betrayal, being betrayed, compulsive control, and bad information in women's magazines, like the time I read in 17 magazine that the vagina had no sensation, that it was basically just an empty sheath, and that the clitoris was the only organ of sexual pleasure. Well, that's not true. That is certainly not true. But it took me a really long time to find out that it wasn't true, because I had just swallowed everything that I was fed like a baby bird with its big beak open. Just swallowed everything I was fed. La petite mort is a French euphemism for orgasm. The little death. The surrender to the unknown that opens into cervical orgasm, the mystical cervix, which is the doorway of life and death. But before the little death, there was death by a thousand tiny cuts, all the injuries and insults to the sacred epicenter of life itself, the yoni. Next time, I'll tell you how I began to rebuild my relationship with her and reclaim her, and what I've learned about sacred intimacy from going into her dark and mysterious depths, where she lay like sleeping beauty, waiting for me to reawaken her divine power. I'll see you next time. Meanwhile, walk in grace. Thank you for joining me in the grace space, where you're always in the right place. If you love this podcast, I invite you to subscribe to it and submit a review.